Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. From Rembrandt to Rothko, and Mozart to Wagner, art and music have the capacity to give us a feeling of the sublime and transcendent wonder. Yet in contemporary culture, the sublime is rare and for the most part, not even desired. So what really is the sublime, and where can we find it in the 21st century? Joining us to debate trash, trends, and the transcendent are thought-provoking author Olivia Fain, journalist and social critic Mina Salami, radical biologist Rupert Sheldrake, and award-winning novelist Joanna Cavenna. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll now hand you over to our host for this debate, Mark Salter.
From Rembrandt to Rothko, from Mozart to Wagner, art and music have always had this amazing capacity to reach to the sublime, the subliminal, the transcendent. But in contemporary culture, all these things seem mysteriously absent. I mean, you know, the WAP video or the art of Takashi Murakami aren't exactly like profound and deep and up there. There's something missing somehow. Is the sublime, whatever that is, an attempt to reach the unreachable? And why is it so rare in modern culture? Or perhaps it was just an illusion, a delusion even, that historically that was what sublime and art were fused together. I mean, do we really need to do something about this and think of perhaps a new way of approaching art in the modern world that reconnects us with the idea of the sublime, the transcendent? Is there some way around this? To our speakers, on my extreme left, we have Olivia Fain. And Olivia, the writer of Why Sex Doesn't Matter, and another book, The Rupture, An Exploration of Knowledge, and what's it called? Knowledge of the Sublime. That was something I wasn't taught to learn off by heart. You've written many articles for The Times, The Guardian, The Daily Mail, I understand. Joanna Cavenna, on my close left, is a multi-award-winning writer, a novelist. Perhaps she's best known for her most recent book, Zed, which I recommend. And she's written very, very widely for a whole range of publications, including The New Yorker, The Huffington Post, The LRB, London Review of Books, The Guardian, The Observer, and New York Times. On my right, I have Mina Salami, who is a Nigerian-Finnish journalist, feminist, and author. She's written quite a few books herself, including Sensuous Knowledge, A Black Feminist Approach for Everyone, and interestingly titled The Power Book, What Is It? Who has it and why? As a key public figure, she's spoken at over 200 universities and cultural events across five continents, so she's busy. And finally, on my far left, we have a legend of parapsychology research, the great Rupert Sheldrake, who's very, very well known for a very wide range of things, and perhaps most controversially, for his theory of morphic resonance.
Yes.
I think is a very interesting concept that set the scientific community thinking. So here we have four people looking at a very different angle on this fascinating idea of the transcendent. So I'd like to ask all of them in the usual fashion to sum up exactly what they're going to say in three pithy minutes. To start with you, Olivia, I want all four of you to answer this simple question. What is the sublime, and has contemporary culture abandoned it? Olivia.
Well, what I love most about the sublime is its violence. Every preconception you've ever had, history, culture, philosophy, religion, just swept away like that. And in fact, there's a very wonderful quote by William Blake in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And he says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, for he is closed down on himself so that all he can see is through the narrow chinks of his cavern. Now, what the sublime does is he zaps us all out of our caverns and propels us into the light. And in fact, that little book I wrote is called The Rupture, and that's exactly what it does, and that's why I love it. Now, of course, nowadays we use the phrase sublime in hey, what a sublime hat or a sublime kitchen, which says more about, I fear, about our culture than about the sublime. We revere the sublime because of its history. Its root was sublimis, meaning simply high or elevated. But what the people who really made it famous were Burke and Kant. And what they talk about is the sublime's unbounded nature. And they compare that to the beautiful, which is bounded, which is all about taste and whatever. But what interests them is the sublime, in the sublime, is its infinite quality, and but also its terror. And the words they use, I mean, Burke talks about terror, astonishment, and Kant about volcanoes and hurricanes and everything. And in fact, Kant's perfect day is to be caught in a terribly violent storm where you practically lose your life and then you reach home. That's a kind of perfect ideal. It's a sublime day, as we might say. Now, in fact, Kant gives art the thumbs down. He thinks that art's all about saying, oh, have you seen the exhibition of such and such an artist or whatever? He thinks it's all about society and showing off. And what he loves is nature.
Johanna, over to you.
Okay, well, I'm going to be
Olivia.
Really
but we've got lots to talk about this evening, okay. So please.
I mean, I agree with lots of everything that Olivia's just said. So as Olivia mentioned, there's this kind of really ancient history to it. And an interesting facet of that is Longinus, who's a sort of third century Roman, is the first person attributed to sort of coin this term. And he's basically writing about art that I like. And he calls it the sublime. So it's kind of very much about taste in art. You know, I like this art, this art's rubbish. So it's kind of that funny idea of taste making that, you know, this is elevated because me and my mates kind of enjoy it. So it's a huge kind of cultural aspect. But then it goes into, as Olivia said, it gets picked up, gets translated, this work, in the 17th century. And by the 18th century, it's so fashionable that, you know, you get sort of the usual culprit sniggering in the back, people like Swift, and Pope start talking about tremendous Longinus and sort of making jokes about him. And then you get, you know, the sort of Burkean idea of terror, awe. But also the thing I really like about the Longinus essay is it's all about incompleteness, that the really interesting stuff in life is unfathomable. You can't quite get to it. And I think that's so interesting. It's such an interesting early expression of what we actually get in lots of art, talking about art. You get Duchamp doing that in the early 20th century. He says that really the artwork is incomplete and it's completed by the audience because the artist never knows enough to say, I've totally finished. And you have that, you know, in loads and loads of art, that idea of a sort of dialogue with the audience. Now with the internet, you could say people think it's the anti-sublime, but actually it's this massive, as David Bowie said actually in the late 90s, this huge kind of incomplete work that everyone kind of participates in. So I think that's a part of it. I've got one other thing to say, is that all right? Also, I think in terms of have we lost the sublime? Well, I'd say in terms of this feeling of incompleteness, unknowability, do we all still feel this sense of immensity, you know, ourselves as mortals, the vastness of space, you know, the enormity of implacable mountains and nature? You know, even though there are now kind of cliches of the sublime, and, you know, you can go and stand on Sublime Point and see the supposedly sublime view, I think these fundamental feelings are still absolutely intrinsic, not only to art, but also science, life, you know, our general sort of day-to-day experience. So I'd say it's actually a really, you know, contemporary experience because it continues throughout time. And whether we call it the sublime or not, it's sort of present.
Thank you.
Is that all right?
It is. Minna.
Okay, what is the sublime? I guess the way that I see it is that it's about this kind of human desire to be elevated into some dimension of higher consciousness. And typically, the problem with the sublime, I guess I'm a little bit more critical of it, is that it has been defined by such a small group of people, typically people of the upper classes, men, and it has a Eurocentric kind of definition. Sometimes these people have contributed very positively to the definition of the sublime. So Olivier was speaking about Kant, for instance, and I can't remember the name of the book now, where he distinguishes between the sublime and the beautiful, but you know, he saw the sublime as something connected to the masculine, and the beautiful is connected to the feminine and to women. So there's like creating this kind of exclusion of women from the sublime. The pursuit of the sublime has also been very classed, you know, so some of the examples that you mentioned, Mozart, Wagner, you know, these are definitions of the sublime which have, you know, in which there's a class discrimination, and also the way that it has been assigned to the arts world. And particularly, I guess we start to think of, or when we hear the sublime in arts, we think of like 19th century artists. Which is a period in which women artists are very much excluded once again. I recently read a book, which I'll plug because I thought it was so brilliant, by an author called Jennifer Higgy. It's called The Mirror and the Palette. And it's all about women artists in the 19th century and beyond. But you know, it's really interesting to think of who was excluded from the definition of what the sublime is. As I was thinking through this question, I thought about the kind of the etymological roots of the sublime and how it's very related to the term subliminal. And that kind of maybe helps to respond to the latter part of the question, where I think people are maybe more interested in the subliminal aspect of the sublime today. So I don't think that contemporary culture has rejected it, but because it's history of exclusion, I think it's just shifted. And what we find today is probably a search for the sublime in different places, most especially, I think, in nature. So there's a lot of, there's a sort of desire to elevate and find higher dimensions through connecting with the land. And, you know, there's a lot of that kind of discourse going on, which I think is very much about the sublime, but also the subliminal.
Thank you. Rupert.
Well, I agree about nature as being the constant source of inspiration. It wasn't historically, or people just find nature frightening. I mean, mountains, torrents, and so on. It became fashionable in the Romantic period. But today, the nature is one of the great sources of sublime experience or transcendent experience for many people. There are also experiences that are more inner experiences, like through psychedelics. Many people who take psychedelics have experiences of going way beyond their normal state of consciousness into a state which seems more beautiful, more interesting, more fascinating, more vivid, and opening a door to something greater than themselves. But that's a personal experience. And if we look at the history of different human cultures, we see that they've actually collectively tried to represent the sublime and create the experience of it for the whole culture. In Egypt, they did it through those great buildings, the pyramids and the temples. In India, the great temples of India, the wonderful Buddhist temples in Thailand and in other parts of Asia, wonderful mosques and tombs in the Islamic world, and in the Christian world, the great cathedrals, the great temples we have. People have also tried to do it through music, through sacred chant particularly, and through uplifting music, like in the Christian tradition, things like Bach's B minor Mass and his cantatas, and through sacred song. And actually, here we are in a secular modern Britain, but every day in our land, the perpetual choirs are singing in all our great cathedrals. There are incredibly well-trained choirs singing every evening choral evensong in incredibly beautiful buildings. So it's not as if it's gone away. It's still here, what we've inherited from the past in our own culture here in Europe. It's just that most people don't know about it or don't care about it or are detached from it. But if you're interested, there's a website called choralevensong.org where you can find out what they're singing and even hear it streaming. So what I'm saying really is that there's these attempts culturally to reach out to the sublime and create environments where you can experience it, like great cathedrals and temples and mosques and the Taj Mahal and so on, are very much part of the way our cultures were in the past. Today, there's not much effort, collective effort, goes into that. It goes more into entertainment, building banks and so on, airports and whatnot, shopping malls. But it hasn't gone away, and we still have the heritage of the past, thank goodness. And maybe we could exceed it in the future. But for now, I think it's as well to remember what we already have.
Indeed, and what we may be losing. So this transcendent, is something I want to look at and look at the reason perhaps for its decline. But before we go through that, I'd just like to think a bit more about what we actually mean by the transcendent. We've heard fear, horror, nature, art, psychedelic experience, and Rupert has referred to in many ways, and on one occasion even advertised, this idea of God. Now, that's one word that we haven't heard so far, nor have we heard the word awe, A-W-E, awe, which I think is a fascinating word. So, could you give us a robust definition of the sublime and the transcendent, beyond perhaps what you've already said?
Well, I can't give a robust definition, but I can say something about how I understand it, which I think is recognizing that there's conscious forces, beings, experiences greater than our own, and that through these experiences of the transcendent sublime, we become aware of the fact we're part of something much greater than ourselves. And it can be terrifying because it can seem as if our ego or ourself will be annihilated. And the poet who I think expresses this best is Rilke, the German poet, who says beauty is that terror we're only just able to bear. That there's something about beauty which is terrifying. And I've noticed this, if you're in an amazing place, you've been invited to drinks with somebody who's got an incredible house with amazing view, there's cocktails and there's the terrace and stuff. And you all look at the sunset for about 30 seconds, and then somebody says, well, this reminds me of something I saw in Bali last year. And somebody says, oh, yeah, well, I saw a scene a bit like some amazing sunset. And you're immediately somewhere else because it's too much to bear. It threatens to overwhelm us. And so I think there's a way in which we're frightened by it as well. But for many people, when they have experiences of the transcendent through mystical experiences, it's the most important experience or experiences of their lives. People have had near-death experiences lasting about 2 minutes when they feel themselves going out of their body into another realm of joy, peace, bliss. And when they come back, they're usually rather disappointed that it's only a near-death experience. When they've had these experiences, people who've had them, many of them say it's completely changed their life. They now have a much greater sense of meaning. They've lost the fear of death and so on. They change people, these experiences, in a way that ordinary entertainment doesn't. Because they're transformative, I think that's one reason they're so frightening.
Thank you. So can I ask then, perhaps the rest of the panel, their views, because you will, about what are the forces at work that have actually sort of started to banish this from our world?
Well, I would say actually science has. I mean, one of the expressions I completely hate is God of the gaps, which basically said all that sort of awe, that religious impulse that our sort of ancestors had, well, it was because they didn't think scientifically, and science has explained lightning and thunder, and therefore they don't need God to say there's Zeus and the thunderbolts and the Jupiter and all the rest of it. And what upsets me about this is that it imagines that our ancestors had our minds, our sort of right and left-hand brains, we're all analytical, we're over-educated. And there was some kind of Stone Age classroom where they said, we don't know what water's made of. Put that in the column under God again. Could you do that, please? Yes, yes, boys and girls. Because the truth is, it wasn't like that. People didn't think like that. They thought like this. And what's interesting is that 200,000 years ago, men and women had the same size brains as us. They were like us. They didn't have our education, but they were like us. And they would have looked at a lake or a sea or whatever, and they would have thought wow. And this is the awe that you mentioned. They would have thought, wow. And we've lost sight of that, basically, because of science. And what's interesting, I think, is that their response, they responded to nature in a way. They did that firsthand. And we've just lost the art, if it's an art. I don't think it is an art. I think it's a natural human thing, actually. But we've lost that because we live in cities and everything like that.
So we've lost it. Minna, what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I really agree with what Olivia's saying. And I think the transcendent is, it's insofar that it's an experience that that can be like, it kind of shifts your perspectives towards something progressive, towards something better and beautiful. You know, it's such an important experience that human beings can have. And yet, the way that we talk about it, like, I think we need so much more critical thinking around it, which is part of what you're saying, like, you know, going back to our ancestors. And the thing with transcendence is that the way that we typically approach it is coming to science eventually, but let me see if I can put this in a more practical way. So it goes back to this kind of Platonic idea of there being a better existence somewhere in a different plane than ours. So the transcendent is very much seen as outside of this world. And I think that that's a big problem, because what that creates then is this issue of not being able to connect with nature directly. So instead, and this is, again, it's, you know, it's this small group of men who typically then have, like, theorized around the transcendent, stemming from the Platonic idea of it existing somewhere else, and made it something so sort of distant and abstract and esoteric that it's almost, you know, it's intangible for most people, when it's actually something that we really need, because it can enrich our lives individually and collectively. And so in the feminist tradition, not necessarily all feminism, but I think that this notion of rapture, maybe, it can help to be generative when we think of transcendence as well, because there's a need for transcendence to be brought back to Earth, you know, to pluralism, to our bodies, to a way that we can experience transcendence actually in this very world that we live in, and not just where God is or where the abstract is, and so on.
It's starting to make our modern world seem like a pretty dull, suffocated place. I mean, Joanna, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, trans, let's go first of all. Trans means beyond, scandare means to climb. So let's sort of, if we think of where transcendent comes from, and this idea of sort of, you know, climbing beyond whatever is before us. And again, that just means you're trying to push at the limits, or push at, you know, at the, again, the sort of sublimin, actually, it comes from going up to the threshold, with this idea of the lintel, actually, of a door. You know, you're kind of just trying to get up there. And again, you know, yes, there's lots of problems in the modern world, you know, of course. But I think that sort of desire, that kind of pushing at the limits of whatever it is, scientific knowledge, look at the extraordinary kind of, look at quantum physics. I mean, if that isn't in touch with, you know, the ineffable, awe and terror, you know, completely sort of bonkers, you know, various really interesting ways. Look at, you know, robotics or AI consciousness, or all these kind of extraordinarily sort of pushing at the threshold of notions of mind or self kind of creations. I think with art, you know, all interesting art kind of pushes at the limits of whatever's acceptable in a society. And it's really interesting, Mina's mentioned the kind of resistance, absolutely right, to Burke. You get someone like Mary Wollstonecraft, who's, you know, writing in response to Burke's 1757 essay, and she says, look, this term's annoying because Burke's obsessed with, you know, men are sublime and women aren't, you know, they're just beautiful. But she then sort of reappropriates the sublime, and she's someone who's really pushing at the limits, of course, of what's acceptable. And because of her, actually, there is a kind of counterattack with Gothic feminist fiction, people like Anne Radcliffe, kind of taking this idea of awe and terror in, you know, into the sort of fictional realm, and saying, well, actually, we are going to sort of seize this. So I don't think, you know, I think there's always a kind of play of these cultures and, you know, people doing sort of different things at different times and trying to sort of counteract, you know, the sort of orthodoxy. I think once the sublime becomes generic, you take it from the individual, and it has to be an individual experience. So literally, if we're all told to go to one place and we'll feel sublimity, and there'd be a big queue, you know, and they'd run out of sandwiches, you know, it'd be really rubbish. So that's not going to be sublime. You know, we again, in our own selves, we have to kind of push at the threshold of that experience, you know, of all our experiences, to try and find that path that we're all trying to sort of find, that's our own kind of driven path.
I mean, what about art now? Can you think of things that do still succeed in, you know, rising above this suffocation? You know, examples perhaps you can all draw from your own experiences of sublime in stuff that's being made and generated and put out there, not necessarily in particle physics, but in the world day to day. Is it invisible? Is it non-existent?
I thought it was interesting in the introduction you mentioned the WAP video, and for people who are not familiar with it, it's Nicki Minaj and Megan Thee Stallion have a video which is incredibly raunchy. You know, we see that, I guess, more as trashy than transcendent. And personally, I kind of agree, not that it's trashy, but I don't find it empowering from a feminist perspective. I think it's catering very much to the male gaze, even though it's also subverting it somehow. But I do think that it's really important to say that, I guess for younger generations, my sense is that what older generations and like our ancestors thought of as the sublime, today for young people is maybe characterized more by things that are magical or epic or sensational. And there's something about that video, for instance, that gets people talking, and there's something to analyze in it. There's also this kind of resistance to the sublime, which has always been, you know, very classed, as I said. The sublime is a space which has really constricted people's behavior and been very normative and said, you know, this is how you're a lady or whatever. And there's something in this video that's saying that, no, we don't want to be socially acceptable. You know, this is something different. And it's also kind of blurring the lines between pornography, I guess, and art, which the kind of old-fashioned school would say, oh, no, you can't do that. But I just think that people who are into that kind of art form, that art expression, are also seeking something sublime.
I can't help but see a similarity there to gospel music in the 18th and 19th century as a way of something very powerful and transcendent tied to Christianity. And latterly, after that, jazz. I mean, you know, these things really, it seems to me, have broken these levels. But, you know, I just wonder if you could have some more examples of perhaps guide the way we can get back to it that are happening in our contemporary culture.
Oh, that's too...
Beyond the wet video.
I think it's hopeless. I'm afraid I think the sublime is completely dead. There's a couple of amazing composers. Max Richter, if anyone's heard of him, wonderful composers that take you there. But I have to say, you know, we were all asked actually to watch the WAP video, and we were asked also to look at this art by a Japanese artist, by Murakami. And I don't know if any of you have seen this WAP video. Actually, I watched it. It was very interesting. I was thanking whoever decided we should watch it, because this is my first introduction to modern culture. And and actually, I found myself singing sort of along. There are whores in the house. There's whores in the house. It was a good song. And actually, I think if art is an expression of a culture, it absolutely, in fact, both of them absolutely express our own culture. I mean, you know, what are our obsessions? Sex and shopping. Murakami looked like he'd designed a shower curtain for kids for Tesco. You know, this is what we do. In fact, as for the sort of, the feminist angle, I thought that was astonishing. Though my mother used to say to me, women will always be more powerful men than men, because we have what men want, our bodies. And I think that is the sort of message of this sort of reclaiming our sexuality video. But I have to say, the language was really shocking to me. You know, I want to gag, I want to feel pain, you know, do all these things to me, please. And it was like, what is that about? And the trouble is, it might be totally, totally clever, but the people who are watching it and getting aroused by it aren't. They might not be super clever. And, you know, and women on the whole aren't super beautiful. Like, I hope all of you are going to be watching it when you go home tonight. It's really sexy. It works. But as for sublime, I fear it is really, really gone, dead and gone.
Rupert, Minna, perhaps you could square the idea that it's dead. I mean, Are we not going a bit too far if we say that the sublime is dead in the modern world? Are we really that stuffed?
Well, I'm afraid I didn't do my homework. And,
You've got a different kind of pussy.
And, yes, I'm afraid I haven't actually seen the WAP video yet. So I don't have an opinion about it. But I would say that we live in a very secularized culture, and anything to do with God or religion is usually filtered out of public life. It's simply, you can't, you know, no one ever goes to church or sings hymns or prays on television or anything. It's been privatized. Everything to do with religion has been privatized. And when they were doing the Downton Abbey series, somebody asked, why don't they ever show them saying grace before meals? Because at that time, they would have said grace before meals. The answer is because it might have offended atheists to have grace on television. So we live in a culture where secularism isn't just seen as a way of not favoring one religion over another, but the default position is non-religious or even anti-religious. So I think there's something about modern culture which is actually amputating the transcendent and the sublime, but it can't be amputated from human nature, which is why it keeps coming up again in all these different forms. And I think in the modern world, the main way in which people experience it, a lot of young people experience it, is through a kind of psychedelic rite of passage, which I think for many people is an opening to this realm that our education and our culture tends to suppress. So I think that's one way. I think there are also various arts. I mean, I know this is a terribly niche minority interest, choral evensong in cathedrals. There are composers still writing exquisitely beautiful music. Sir John Taverner, for example, which is performed in choral. It's not just 16th century polyphonic music. There's modern composers writing music which is designed to be elevating and inspiring, and actually is in many cases. So it's not as if it's gone away, it's just that it's been marginalized and or sort of put beneath the radar. Even though cathedrals are pretty large, hard to miss, lots of people have never been into them because it's simply not part of secular culture or education to think about these things. So I think we have had a kind of general suppression of the sublime in the name of so-called science and reason.
Oh, gosh, do you mind if I say something?
Please do.
No, but you remind me of that story of the cathedral. You remind me of that because about 15 years ago, I was on a train with a young lad of 20, and I saw he was reading a philosophy book. And, of course, I had to talk to him. What was he reading? What was he doing, etc. This boy, this young man, was a decorator. He had left school at 16 because school was completely boring, and he was going to see Salisbury Cathedral, because it was the most beautiful building in the world, the most sublime building in the world, and he was going to listen to evensong. So there he was going to look at this building, he was going to listen to this music, and he was reading a book on philosophy, but he left school at 16 because our education is so boring. What was he doing? He should have been at university. He should have been, you know, thinking, being, but he was there on a train. What was he doing? It shows, you know, the sublime is dead if he has to do that.
Can I just say, though, that we're, very quickly, you know, we're at an ideas and arts festival, and obviously people here are interested in philosophy and these big ideas, but also I've been, you know, catching lots of very young artists who are performing amazing music. Like, there's lots of jazz, there's Bulgarian indigenous music, so I think we also need to just insert that the sublime is perhaps not entirely gone.
Hasn't every culture has always sort of protested its own demise? It's almost, again, it's like, you know, every culture announces its own senescence as well. So, you know, like the sort of commode argument, sense of an ending. And I agree with Minna, there's fantastic work going on. There's, you know, Arthur Jaffer's exhibition was great, all the sort of found objects and creating kind of beautiful art from sort of the randomness of life. Or Dorothy Cross, she makes, you know, bathtubs, you know, she puts, instead of the scum line, she puts kind of, you know, gold leaf into it, so you sort of transmute mortality into, I think there's great work going on. I could carry on. But Mark asked me to talk about civilizational damage and darkness too.
What are the dark forces at work here that make such intelligent people seem so gloomy about this?
Well, I think, okay, there's one, I was interested in sublime as the unfathomable, the incomplete. And I think there is a sort of civilizational damage that is going on. So lots of the art I know about, I find out from the internet, so it's wonderful in many ways. But there's also this sort of binary culture that's going on, which is the culture of the sort of bit, you know, this sort of basic, you know, kind of binary digit, the most basic unit of computing. And bear with me, but this is either zero or one. Everything is one thing or the other. And it means that when you go in these kind of decision tree worlds, you have these formulated choices for you, this or that. And it completes everything for you. And I think this entire culture of friend, unfriend, like, dislike, everything is sort of decided for you. You can only have one or the other. And maybe if we're going to reclaim the sublime, it's going to exist in the sort of, again, going beyond all of that, this sort of civilizational damage, I think, that's coming through as part of our own culture. And maybe you're... You know, your man on the train is absolutely right to kind of go off to Salisbury Cathedral instead and, well, you know, switch off his phone or whatever it is.
Well, what I'd love to say to Minna, just about jazz, because I've been noticing this, that I listen to music with different parts of my body. And there's a lot of music nowadays that you listen, you know, with a lower stomach, it's kind of sexy, like, you know, Carly B was really sexy. And then you have your heart and you listen to a sort of lovely sort of trio, Haydn, sort of gentle thing or whatever. And then you have higher still, and that's where you listen to Sir John Taverner, higher still. You listen to it, and they're all valid and lovely ways of listening to music. And I love jazz, and I don't want to do jazz down at all. I'm just saying you don't feel awe. You don't feel like that. I love jazz, so I'm not doing down lots of songs, and you know, but I just don't think jazz is sublime.
The opening bars to So What by Miles Davis, I call that sublime. I want to come back to push you further on this. I mean, where is this suffocation, this supposed suffocation, coming from? Is it capitalism? Is it greed? Is it just fear? I mean, are we running away from things that scare us these days? And if so, why? What's going on?
Capitalism certainly plays a big role. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to hold the sublime and a capitalist culture together where, you know, to Joanna's point, I think we're seeing so much art being produced based on algorithmic value. So, you know, something is getting a lot of likes and suddenly it's an album or a movie or a book. and that really mitigates how much sublimity we can experience. So, I definitely think that capitalism is part of the civilization.
I've said quite a lot, but I'd love to say one more thing. One more thing, just because my son spent some summers going to Ghana, teaching maths there, rural Ghana in the middle of nowhere. And he said in that first phone call when he rang home, he said, oh my goodness, I have witnessed human happiness for the first time. It's really odd watching these people going up the streets, doing this, doing that, and they're all smiling and they're all full of joy. Now, these people live in mud huts. Few of them wear shoes. There's just enough space for lying down under the roof when they go to sleep. And I said, why? Why are they so happy? They also have this awful diet of plantain, tasteless vegetable. They eat nothing else. And I said, why do you think they're happy? And my son said, well, the thing is that for 3 hours every night under this incredibly black, starry sky, they sing. They sing these incredible songs. And I said, what are they singing about? And he said, they are praising God. And I was thinking very sadly, you know, our modern missionaries, okay, bad, you know, old missionaries got a very bad name, but our modern missionaries will say, what are you saying? God is dead. What matters is our sexuality. What matters is going shopping. What matters is desire. You know, we've just lost the plot.
But you can have the sublime without God.
Religion is man-made, but the response, that original response of those people 200,000 years ago to what they saw, that wow, was real. And they were responding to something which was real in the same way as mathematicians respond to numbers which are real. They were responding to spirit or something.
But everybody, I think we're all responding to something real. We're all having a real life. And, you know, so that, I mean, this again, and these, you could say if you believe in the Eastern tradition that all the sort of, you know, the cultural aspects are kind of Maya to some extent. And there's just this experience of, you know, trying to fathom the universe from your individual perspective in conjunction with other people who are trying to do the same thing. And I think that's sublime, and that's what art, you know, literature, philosophy, experience, conversation that's interesting is about. And I don't see that you have to, you know, say, well, there's any particular sorts of art that do that well. I mean, different people will find different forms of art. Lots of people will find the WAP video sublime, fine. You know, if that's how you get to it, fine. You know, you don't have to, I mean, even song's lovely, but, you know, some people might find that less exciting, you know. So I just think, again, if we have these, you know, throughout history, the whole of the culture industry has been controlled by a tiny quantity of very, very rich people with funny ideas about things. And we all kind of live in the aftermath. And, you know, this debate, the sublime debate, is generated really by lots of aristocrats going on holiday in Europe and going, darling, the mountains were sublime, and sort of elevating their gap year, really. I mean, that's really what was going on. And so now we're all here, you know, 250 years later. You know, but why don't we just forge our own version of these things, kind of reclaim them, and actually operate as ourselves living these lives? And if art is exciting and speaks to us, and great, if it doesn't, then you just ignore it. You know, I mean, that's why.
There is a pattern emerging here. The tiny individual with its personal experience can and the universe. And it seems to me then, we've got a robust definition of the sublime now. Anything that makes us connect to something vastly bigger than ourselves. Was that how you began, Rupert, as I recall? I mean, why should that be?
I don't know. I think that something about our nature is bound up with everything else. We're linked to everything else. We're not separated individuals. We have obviously separate bodies, but we're part of a social system. We totally depend on other people. We depend on nature, the sun, the earth. It's just simply a fact. And if we acknowledge that there's this connection and dependence, then I think we're, as it were, going with the flow of reality, and going with the flow induces happiness and a sense of connection. Most positive psychology research shows that people feel happy when they're in the flow, and it can be the flow of singing or dancing or helping others or work they're really absorbed in, or music. But being part of something greater than oneself is usually what makes people happy. Being separated, alienated, detached, isolated is what makes people depressed on the whole. I mean, you're an expert on depression. Would you agree with that as a general?
Psychiatrist, I can't deny that, certainly. Mm. But I'm fascinated by this idea that capitalism, you seem to be saying, separates us from each other. That seems to be what's going on here, or makes us selfish in the modern world.
I don't think capitalism is the basic problem. I mean, I'm not pro-capitalist myself, but if you look at the communist regime in the Soviet Union, that wasn't necessarily brilliant on the sublime. So there we've got a communist system. And if you look at capitalism in the 19th century England, when it was in a particularly raw and aggressive and uncaring form, it was not particularly associated with a debasement of public taste. I mean, there were some spectacular buildings and some wonderful public buildings constructed. So I don't think it's capitalism per se, nor do I think it's that socialism or communism is necessarily better, nor even national socialism. I mean, the Nazis had another take, and they built monumental buildings, but mostly ones that were an expression of power. I think it's I think it's basically the attempt to abolish religion and a pro sort of atheistic secularist culture, and many atheists are secular humanists and actually have a kind of altruistic morality. So I don't think it's to do with morality either. I think it's to do with a belief system that says the sublime or the transcendent simply doesn't exist. The universe is nothing but mindless matter, purposeless. Evolution has no purpose. Sublime experiences, theories of thing, experiences of the divine, are nothing but changes inside our heads, inside our brains. And there's no more to it than that. And to imagine there's more to it than that is just to succumb to an illusion that's believed in by ignorant, stupid, and childish people. I mean, that's a very common attitude, and our educational system tends to implicitly
foster that.
Favor that attitude.
Yes, I understand. Well, look, I think we can get on for quite a long time with this, but I think the most important thing now is for us to thank our speakers this afternoon.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.